Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. Hacks and Flacks is the only series where you'll get the inside scoop on how journalist hacks and the flacks of government and business work behind the scenes to decide which stories you'll be reading with your morning coffee, and perhaps more importantly, how they keep certain headlines off the front pages. What happens if a public figure is a subject of a salacious story? When does a scandal make or break a career? And how do you really know what is or isn't fake news? All these subjects and a whole lot more will be explored by me and a regular panel of hacks and flacks, ready to spill the beans and tell us how the sausages get made. Flacks like former government advisers Giles Kenningham.
Hello.
And Andrew McDougall.
Hello.
Plus hacks like Mick Booker.
Hello.
So now all the gang's here, let's delve into the world of hacks and flacks.
I think it became untenable for me at EastEnders because when your contract is, you can't bring the show into disrepute. They ran so many stories about us. I think it kind of put the nail in the coffin for me with my job.
Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks. Today we're looking at how the consequences of phone hacking and press intrusion still cast a shadow over its victims and the tabloid press. In a moment, I'll be speaking to someone who even suspected her own family of selling intimate stories about her to the newspapers. But before that, let's welcome this week's panel and say hello to Mick Booker.
Hello.
Giles Kenningham.
Hello.
Andrew McDougall.
How do you do?
And also Tom Anerley. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Who has worked on a number of high-profile court cases and public inquiries, including most recently Grenfell. Today, we're looking at how the consequences of phone hacking and press intrusion still cast a shadow over its victims and the tabloid press. In a moment, I'll be speaking to someone who even suspected her own family of selling intimate stories about her to the newspapers. Mick, phone hacking is still being talked about. It was an absolute betrayal, wasn't it? Do you think this is why the public distrust the mainstream news, or one of the reasons at least?
Well, it's clearly one of the more modern reasons, but I don't recall going into being a tabloid journalist and everyone trusting me in the first place, to be perfectly honest. So I think there's clearly it did, and it created some huge problems for the press, for editors like me. You know, at the time I was deputy editor on the Daily Express. I think when the first case started on the News of the World with the Royal Report of Clive Goodman earlier in the noughties, which was the first one that came out and was seen to be just the isolated incident, or that's what we thought. But that's when I was on the Daily Star Sunday, and obviously that was more in that market where there was those sort of stories and the celebrities had been targeted. I mean, I would say I look back, and we started the Daily Star Sunday in 2002. And there was only about four or five of us, and we were supposed to be in that market up against the News of the World, the Sunday Mirror, the Sunday People. Now, as we look back, a lot of those stories now were a result of phone hacking, but we were always thinking, how are they getting all these great stories? They're all over there.
You had
they
no must clue. Be.
Well, again, I count myself very lucky. I'd just come down to London like the year before. The people on the Daily Star Sunday, the nature of it was set up to be this cheap alternative. So it was a lot of young people who were new to the industry, hadn't worked in Sunday newspapers. So we weren't, you know, as street smart as some of those other people in the other newspapers. And what had seemed to have happened, looking back at it, is that wherever it originated, it seemed to move around some of those newspapers as the staff moved around. But luckily, they didn't come to our place, because if it had, at that point, and remember pre the moment when it turned out that Millie Dowler, her phone had been hacked, pre then, people were kind of rolling their eyes at it a little bit and thinking, well, it's just celebrities, it's just royals and things like that. I might myself have got into it thinking, well, is it illegal? I don't know. I think a lot of it was naivety, a lot of people on those desks.
I suspect it just got desensitized, right?
Yeah,
I think so, becomes normalized in a way that all other kind of sort of activities in terms gathering, getting stories.
I can't speak for those people on those newspapers, but having seen some of the people who did get convicted and people who were mixed up on it, it sounded as though it just, that's what we do here.
That's part of the terror.
And then you don't think of a victim at the end of the day. And again, I don't think the wider public and the, well, politicians, we had David Cameron reacted to it very quickly once the Millie Dowler case came out and she was missing at the time. Yeah. Police were looking for her. The News of the World almost had themselves an extra branch of the security services at one point, when the way that they operated.
Well, paying the police.
Well, working with the police in that way and phone hacking themselves. And then it was that moment when Millie Dowler's phone, the story about that came out. That's when the real revulsion.
Do you know what's interesting? So I remember that moment. This is when The Guardian revealed that Millie Dowler's phone had been hacked. I think they also asserted at the time, which actually transpired to be wrong, that it had been hacked and they deleted messages off it. But they broke that story on a Monday. News of the World was closed by the Sunday.
And this is because the parents were seeing the phone being accessed.
That's right.
Yeah. And believed her to still be alive. Yeah. That was the horror in this.
Yeah, because it was obviously a big watershed moment and there was huge political pressure on David Cameron. And Labour thought it was going to be this big game-changing moment in terms of shifts in public perceptions, shifts in perceptions about the Tories. And then it was a tsunami of pressure. But when you actually polled it, the public still thought, this is about celebrities. This is about well-known people. It was seen very much in that bucket. And in that way, it didn't cut through to electorate or didn't negatively shift perceptions of the Conservatives, of David Cameron, which Labour thought it was. And they thought it was a moment where they would go toe-to-toe with the press and Murdoch. But it was like, if you're going to go toe-to-toe with them, be careful what you wish for, because they didn't sort of change things in the way they thought they were going to change things. They thought they could kind of, you know, fundamentally, I think, change the whole media landscape in the UK, which they didn't.
Andrew, this was our toilet. Did you hear it flush in Canada?
Yeah, you did, in that it's a sense that, you know, you're looking at strange exotic zoo animals and going, why are these things doing these things? Because the press in Canada, for better or for worse, and I think largely for worse, are very passive, very docile, very respectful. And you know, the public's perception in Canada of the British press is that it is very much this irreverent, vibrant,
still
noxious, yeah, like rowdy kind of no holds barred thing where people do slug it out and there is tremendous competition for papers. And you look at it and you go, well, that's the way the incentives are weighted there, is that you make your name on the stories you get. Every editor has to get stories. And then suddenly you're in this position, as many people come to in their lives, where the ends have to justify the means. And so the Clive Goodmans and people that get, you know, on high pressure royal beats and stuff, where that really did shift papers. You had to come up with that stuff. And if you didn't come up with that stuff, your editor was going, why aren't you coming up with that stuff? And if you didn't come up with it enough weeks in a row, you'd be out on your ass. And that whole culture is very much not non-existent in Canada. And it really, on the political side, nobody obviously paid it any mind really in Canada, because it wasn't a public policy issue in Canada. But it was when Andy Coulson and, you know, Cameron's staff started getting implicated in, like, what was their role when they were in these newspapers. That's when it kind of came into a more political. But by and large, it was just like, what are you people doing?
A Canadian paper is really sort of polite and dull.
Sorry, I was just reading.
Apart from what, the Globe and Mail, you don't really have a national paper.
Well, not anymore. So you'd have the Toronto Star, which still claims to be the largest circulation daily, but that's largely in the metropolitan area of Toronto that drives those sales. And Conrad Black, Lord Black, former Lord Black, set up the National Post around 1998 to compete. But yeah, because the country is also seven time zones long, right? It is very much kind of regionalized media markets and television. So our version of the BBC tells the national story, and the private sector broadcasters get a national audience, but the papers are still very much regional. And in Ottawa itself, you know, the thing that makes, I think, the British media unique is London is the center of not only politics, but business, media, the arts, and everything. So the competition and the grist for the mill here is such that you can have those competitive beats. You can have 11, 12, 13 papers fighting it out. You can have Sunday papers that do nothing like that. And that just doesn't exist. But yeah, I mean, it is really a question of leadership and attitudes. And here, people are under such pressure to win the circulation wars that they will do whatever it takes, just like a trader will do whatever it takes to get the edge they need on a deal.
Tom, obviously, this led to an inquiry. And if you speak to the public about inquiries, we think there's one every 5 minutes. How bad does it have to be before an inquiry of the nature of Leveson is launched?
Of the nature of Leveson, it's got to be pretty bad. It's a certain type of inquiry. It's a statutory inquiry. So it's reserved for very serious things. And if you look at the ones we've had recently, you've got the post office scandal, greatest miscarriage of justice of recent years, probably ever, right? You've got Grenfell Tower, absolute tragedy. Hundreds of people dying or bereaved of their loved ones. And then with Leveson, yeah, it was, as Giles said, about celebrities, but it was also brought on by the Millie Dowler case. It was by a case that the public felt really passionate about. And also, really, it was about something that was undermining trust in the entirety of newspapers. So actually, it was a major issue of proper national concern that needed addressing.
People also want to know why they're so expensive.
Because usually they take years, and there's a lot of lawyers, and there's loads of disclosure. I mean, the ones I've worked on, you are talking hundreds of thousands of documents, often going back 5, 10, sometimes even 20 years. And on some of the ones I've been working on, you're doing modern day stuff, so you're going through Microsoft Teams messages and WhatsApp. But then you're going back to when stuff was sent on fax or where the only stuff was handwritten, and you're trying to go through all this information, all this written material, piece it all together and find a coherent narrative of what happened, what went wrong and why. That takes a lot of time.
And often in a highly verbal environment too, because, you know, like rule number one, if you're going to commit a crime, don't commit that down to paper anywhere.
Well, that is what seemed to get the news of the world particularly, wasn't it? Because they did it in such an organized way. And Glenn Mulcair, who was the private investigator, he kept meticulous records. Again, just in that very highly organized way that the news of the world had got used to doing. They were a very slick machine. They were the best stories on every single page, every single week. They were selling millions of copies. In a way, they were a brilliant operation, and that's what brought them down, because they were so well organized, it was all there written down. Whereas there has been allegations against other newspapers which have paid out but are not admitted liability, but that just seemed to have been one-man band or one-woman band reporters doing it, chucking the phone into a river, and then there's no record of it. You know, if you did it in this day and age, a few years on, you know, it would have all been written down, it would all be on phones, it'd be everywhere.
Before we get to our special guest today talking about hacking, let's just take a moment to really remember how quickly this newspaper fell, this behemoth. I mean, that was shocking. It was startling, wasn't it? Would you ever expect it to have seen that?
We were sat in an afternoon conference at the Daily Express, and I've never seen shock like it. I remember it was a lad called Tom Morgan, who worked on the news desk, came running in, must have been about 4:05, and said, "The news of the world shut down." And we were all just gobsmacked. Recently with the Queen dying, it was like that sort of moment. Then there was the announcement, it was the last edition on that Sunday. That Sunday came out, and I remember there was TV cameras there and all the staff came out with the final edition. But then Fleet Street clicks back into action the next week, and then all the other tabloids think, there's a big gap in the market there.
Yeah.
You know, I remember the Daily Star Sunday that I'd used to work on. When I left, it was down to about 250,000 copies they were selling. Scroll on the week after the news of the world goes out of business, and then they were back to 500,000.
I know this sounds like a daft question. Was it just the hacking? Was it the fines that they had to pay? Because they would blouse through.
I just remember it was febrile, particularly in newsrooms and the political atmosphere of the time. And then we had, Mr. Murdoch, didn't he fly into the country as well? And they were having these summits. And it was triggered by the Millie Dowler case. And they couldn't get around that fact that, look at this grieving family, look at this murdered child. They really had nowhere to turn. And they had to sacrifice the news of the world to show how sorry they were.
Giles and Andrew, I was going to say, in PR terms, was that the only way that they could have gone? I can't help but think if they'd managed to just hold on in there and been hugely apologetic, they might have survived.
I think it probably was the only way. And even that didn't stop the dam, right? Because then there was a wider investigation into press ethics, payments of public officials, payments to the police, the fact this wasn't just limited to one paper, it was other papers across different news groups. So I think it was the only option in that situation.
Yeah, because I mean, the danger whenever you're in a scenario like this is can the broader public relate? And to Mick's earlier point about when it's just seen as something about celebrity, most people aren't celebrities, but most people are parents that read newspapers. And when they read about, they imagine it being their daughter or their son and their lives being traduced in this way, and they get angry. And if you're somebody as savvy as Rupert Murdoch, and I think that he knew that people like us were in the room with him going, look, if you're going to shut this down, it's going to take dramatic action. Okay, Giles is right. It didn't end up doing that, but you have to try to cauterize the wound when it's that gaping. And that was the decision. And I remember I had just visited here the week before that went on, and my sister ended up mailing me the last edition of the News of the World. And I think there was even like a free Prince CD in there, memory serves. Anyways, like bizarre things you remember. But it was momentous that newspaper
really
had shut down.
It's
just incredible.
But in a way, it's textbook, right? You limit the damage to one brand amongst the group, and someone's paid a price, then you move on.
So it seemed that there's been a sacrifice. Well, earlier on, I did speak to somebody who was one of the victims of the hacking scandal, actor Lucy Benjamin, who most of you will be familiar with for playing Lisa Fowler in EastEnders. Now, after joining the soap in 1998, she soon found details of her personal life and on-off romance with co-star Steve McFadden splashed across the front pages. Lucy is speaking publicly for the first time about how these stories affected her and the impact that it had on her life, her family, her friendships, and her career. I began by asking when she and Steve first started pointing the finger of blame at each other. Lucy, this is something that I know you don't talk about because it was such a traumatic time of your life. You were in a relationship with a fellow actor and you've been seeing each other for some time and suddenly there was a trust issue between you. Can you talk me through that moment when you started to kind of look at each other sideways?
It's funny because I don't think I did look at Steve sideways, Steve McFadden, who I was dating at the time. I got a sense that he was looking at me sideways because it seemed to be that I was the main protagonist, really, of everything. That it seemed to be that it was me that was in that seemed to be in trouble, and Steve was always seemed to be quite private. I know that he'd had a few run-ins with the press, but I just got a sense that when things started running the papers about our relationship, that he was looking at me. And so that was the first initial thought, that things were breaking down between us because I felt that he was kind of accusing me of going to the papers. Or maybe having been, even sometimes I think, overheard saying things because, you know, I'll have a glass of wine and I'll start chatting to people and, you know, I can be quite vocal and I wear my heart on my sleeve. So it was that, really. And that was the initial kind of breakdown in things. And then I was kind of having to go, I promise I haven't done anything like that. And then I started to look outside of that and then look at my own family, thinking, you know, I've sworn to Steve it's not me. And I never, ever thought it was him. It never crossed my mind that it was him. But I immediately went to my own family, and my mum, my brother, colleagues, other colleagues on EastEnders even. I then also blamed myself because everyone was saying to me, it's not me, I haven't done anything, I haven't sold anything. And then I just started to think, it's me, it's totally me, saying things too loudly. And I kind of went a bit mad in the whole process.
This is basically the hacking scandal that we're talking about, which at the time, of course, nobody knew was going on. There were celebrities like you who were in the public eye who would suddenly have very private stories making the front page of the tabloids. And this is where you thought, how is this leaking out?
Absolutely, because things were true. Because often you read stories and go, that's total rubbish, it's been made up. There was a lot of truth in a lot of these stories, and it never, ever crossed my mind, not for a moment, that our phones, our messages were being listened to. You know, my messages were being listened to that I'd left on Steve's phone, vice versa, and then messages that I was leaving on my friends' phones because they were then being hacked as well as a consequence of it. So the kind of damage was going way outside of just us as well. So you can imagine just this kind of confusion. We had access to landlines in our dressing rooms. And I honestly started to think, maybe our phones in our dressing rooms are bugged. Maybe there's bugs in our dressing rooms. Never did I think that people were listening into my own phone messages that I was leaving or receiving.
Steve McFadden has talked about this openly. And he said that it did impact your relationship in terms of his trust in you.
Yeah.
That must have been devastating.
Well, I knew it at the time that it had, and it was just this trying to convince him that it wasn't me. And I did convince him, but I think he just thought I was still being a bit too gobby, in his own words. And funnily enough, he went to court and he stood there, you know, on my behalf. But I didn't go to court and I didn't listen to what he said on the day because I did think it would be too painful to hear. And actually, my lawyers called me afterwards and they said, listen, maybe you should read it because what he's been amazing the way he's backed you up, but it will be quite upsetting to you. And I remember making a point of not wanting to hear what he'd said.
Was that part of the reason you broke up?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I can't think that it was an easy time for us because I think he was equally as confused, really, about what it was all about. And he wanted to believe me, and I think he did believe me. And it probably was part of the reason there was other stuff as well that was going down. I certainly don't think that helped. But it wasn't just the breakdown in me and Steve, it was the breakdown in lots of my relationships with my family. And I think looking back in my mental health, I mean, I remember a conversation my brother said to me. We went for a dinner one evening and he just said to me, Luz, you're acting like a crazy person, because I would sit there and I would be doing sign language to him to speak to him over the dinner table because I thought it was me totally that had blown everything and was being overheard and recorded. And he just said to me, you've lost your mind, because I was saying the people behind us might be listening. I was sign languaging to him to try and converse with him. So I wasn't in a good place. I think ultimately it lost me my job, to be honest. I think it became untenable for me at EastEnders because you know, in your contract is you can't bring the show into disrepute. You know, they ran so many stories about us. And Steve had been there for a long time, and I was kind of, I wasn't surplus to requirements, but I kind of feel like I was the lesser one to lose in all of it. And I think it kind of put the nail in the coffin for me with my job. I mean, I'm very lucky that, you know, I go back now and they realise after everything came out that, you know, it wasn't me, it wasn't my fault. It was too much damage, I think. And it was easy just to get rid of one of us, and that happened to be me.
When the news came out about the hacking and the impact that that had on so many people's lives, what was your initial feeling when you first heard that you'd been hacked?
It was the police that knocked my door. I didn't know. And they said, we need to come and talk to you. The Orange phone network have been in touch with them, and they've given them my number. And that was the first time I realised that I'd been a victim of phone hacking. It was almost a relief, because everything made sense. All the loose ends were tied up, and I didn't feel mad anymore. It resolved things for me. Then I got cross, I think. And then I got more cross once I kind of got involved with lawyers, and I found out exactly to what extent my phone had been hacked and the level of private detectives. Because what you find out as a result of the phone hacking is it wasn't just that. You know, there were private detectives that they put on you. They had to sit outside, and it wasn't just kind of journalists and photographers that were outside. It was private detectives that they'd employed to go outside. And so seeing all the receipts to investigate, which blew my mind.
I'm guessing as well with the hacking that gave license to other people in a way to sell more stories about you. Did you feel that that was another impact of the hacking?
Yes, I suppose, because I became more, I suppose, cachet was higher. I'm more tabloid fodder and open season, I suppose. So yeah, I think it did. But it's funny because I look back at it now, it's almost like I've kind of put it in a box as if it didn't happen to me. It's a really strange thing about protecting myself, I suppose, defence mechanism. Because I kind of feel I had closure, because I went so far as to go to court and I refused just to kind of be paid off. I wanted to go and stand up in a courtroom, as terrifying as that was. I wanted to go and have my day and ask for an apology and just have my peace.
You think it still has an impact on your career? It's so difficult to know, isn't it? Because you don't know what would have happened if you'd stayed at EastEnders or you'd got another acting job immediately afterwards. So the knock-on effect is probably still there today.
Well, I definitely thought that for quite a long time after having gone to court. And that was a big decision about me questioning whether to go to court, because my life was so much about the press can make or break me at that point. And, you know, and I really felt they'd broken me. And I then thought, if I'm taking these guys on, I am never, ever going to get good press again. They are never going to support me in anything. And it was a really, really tough call to make. And I definitely thought for a long time that did impact me. I kind of don't know where that still does, but I don't care. That's the place I've got to now. I don't care. I can't afford to care. I can't let that still be with me, where they kind of have that control. I did think that maybe employers might think, she's too damaged goods, we are not going to get good promo for the show because of what's gone on. But I'm hoping now that producers and bosses see it for exactly what it is now. You know, I'm hoping above hope that they do behave better now. I really believe they are governed a bit more, and I don't think they do it anymore. And I think people went to prison as a result of it. So my faith is back in that, in the system, that bosses believe that doesn't stay with me forever. I have to believe that.
Well, my thanks to Lucy for opening up about what was clearly a terrible experience. And we'll be hearing more from her later in the series, by the way, when she shares some frankly shocking stories about being targeted by the paparazzi. Mick, you can't help, when you listen to Lucy, who I said has spoken about this for the first time, to feel the pain. You're saying that everybody was like, oh, she's just a celebrity. But oh my God, what it did to her.
Well, that's it. I mean, when you're sitting in a newsroom and you're doing stories about people in EastEnders, you do just take it as a bit of fun. It's always Steve McFadden's name that I always think of during that time, because I was fairly new to news editing in a national newspaper, and particularly on a Sunday. And every Saturday night, there seemed to be a different story in most of the Red Tops about Steve McFadden. It was, you know, EastEnders was still that mass watch thing at that time in the early noughties. And he did seem to have a colourful lifestyle, shall we say. And obviously, you've got two soap stars falling out and then getting back together and things like that. And again, our bosses were saying, well, they're getting all these great stories. And it was like, well, it must be money. It's always money. It must be what it is, because, you know, we didn't have a pot to piss in, to be perfectly honest. But the thing is, even though we weren't phone hacking, and obviously, and some others weren't phone hacking, those stories one Sunday, we go, oh, we'll do a follow-up to that story for next week. And then we'll find that person who knows that person who knows that person, and then there might be a line in that. So we'd go and knock on doors and do it that way. But then again, we're just adding to the pain for these people. And as I said, people did think, oh, it's only celebrities, they earn millions of pounds. But really, you know, do you earn millions of pounds on EastEnders and some of these soaps? You don't. But at the end of the day, it's all entertainment, isn't it? It's just an extension of the soap that you see on television. But when you actually hear Lucy say the effect it had on her, then you do realise it's every bit as bad as, you know, someone who's a family of a murder victim and things like that, because it is their lives that are out there, and it is them that distrust between, you know, her and Steve as well. So, you know, the people who do this, you should feel very guilty about doing it. And it is obviously one of the good things about hacking coming to light is that their lives aren't affected like that anymore.
We do not see like any salacious stories in the Sunday papers at all anymore. No. You don't see any kiss and tells, you don't see any shagging stories.
And human nature, everyone loved that.
They're all buy-ups of like biographies and sort of serialization.
But it's because of the public interest.
Yeah, because the public interest test is so high to talk about people's private lives. And so, you know, generally, as we said before, what's interesting to the public is not passing the public interest.
And I think I've said it before, and when I went back to Sunday newspapers when the Sunday Express in 2018, and we used to have this knot in your stomach around about 10 o'clock when all the editions came in and you saw what everyone else had and you thought, oh, well, we've got a load of old crap here, we'll have to start ripping off some of their stories. It didn't happen anymore because no one had anything any good. They'd all come down to my level.
The lowest common denominator. Andrew, the thing that struck me when I was chatting to Lucy was the moment she said to me, what was baffling to her was that these stories were true. You know, they weren't the lies she was used to in the papers. That was the most devastating thing. She's like, how is this happening?
Yeah, and I think when people have read about phone hacking, they've never properly put themselves in the victim's shoes about how awful, and you know, kids throw around the term being gaslit on social media now, but just imagine your own life, the intimate moments of your own life being played back to you and how horrific that must be. And I was struck, when you listen to her trying to work out how this was possibly happening and then thinking, was it actually me? Just being too gobby? Did I have a bit too much to drink at a party and I let slip and now people are selling this stuff about me into the papers and not realizing that it is not your fault. Somebody did this to you. And to Mick's point about it, it's a good thing. One of the benefits that it happened now is that it's not happening now when technology is even more intrusive in your life. And, you know, you've seen with these stories about the Pegasus software that the Israeli company came up with that reads every keystroke that you put on your phone, all your pictures, what you search on Google, all your emails, everything, where you are at all times. Imagine what a malicious actor could do with all that information, blackmail, etc. I know you didn't go home last night because your GPS was co-located here. And you just think about the misery that she experienced and how exponentially worse it would be now. For me, listening to her for the first time, the first time I really had to think about that process of elimination and how shattering that must be to not know who you can trust. And I think celebrities get a bit of that no matter what, because you can never really tell if somebody wants to be your friend because of who you are or who you are in the public sphere. And then to compound that misery by trying to have to triage every relationship you have and figuring out if that's the leak. I mean, God.
The other thing that struck me, Tom, was her not wanting to hear the evidence. Everything that you've done in inquiries is evidence-based. Just put yourself in her shoes with that. Because the evidence would have been as damning as the stories, presumably.
Yeah, presumably. I think it's just hard to relive these things. And when you've suffered as much as she did and gone through that much and doubted yourself and the truth that you were and your family and your friends. And I mean, she said it, she had all sorts of ideas in her head about where these stories were coming from, doubting herself. And I think to then go on a stand or something and say, okay, this is exactly what happened, this is the real truth. Well, you've just spent the last 5 years doubting yourself. So that must just be incredibly difficult. And especially when you are fighting a big entrenched interest and to the press, you know, is that big corporation almost. It's going up against the man or power.
And it was that notion that, and if I do say what I think about their shitty behavior, will they hold it against me? And why should that be fair to be punished again for you being the assholes here? I mean, that's enraging.
Giles, to that point, you know, that was a really tricky decision that she had to make, because you don't want to make enemies of people who make or break your career in that way. What would you have said to her if you were looking after her at that time?
I think there would have been a very fine judgment call. Because remember, this was 10 years ago when papers were a lot more powerful. Circulations were higher. They would drive numbers to EastEnders. Whether she stayed in the cast probably depended, you know, on how big her public profile was. You know, when I was in government, it was a fine line between, you know, we never wanted to go to war with the press. We could be robust, have conversations behind closed doors. But that was always a big judgment call. It'd have to be a big thing to go to war with them. And as I said, that's what Labour Party tried to do off the back of Leveson, but I don't think it moved the dial in the way that perhaps they thought it would.
What a call to have to make, though. Like Andrew's saying, after having been stuffed in that way and then having to feed the beast or starve it.
And ultimately, it's about what the client, what they'll feel comfortable with. Will you be able to sleep at night knowing that you held your tongue in the hope of having future work? Or will you sleep more soundly knowing that you've done the right thing and called out behavior that should be called out? And if you get punished for that, that's not your fault. That's their fault for not realizing what you're trying to do. And it takes courage to do that. But ultimately, it's up to them to say, like, it's fine for us to advise and we will. And you try to work them through these decisions. But ultimately, if they don't feel like it's the right thing to do, then you can't make them do it.
Mick, if I can come to you, in that interview as well, I didn't know this, but detectives were put on these people as well. These newspapers were paying detectives to follow them around. It just goes on and on. Were you aware of that?
There was a huge industry in private detectives across newspapers. A lot of private detectives were used to get addresses for people and things like that that weren't on electoral rolls and things like that. So sometimes a news desk would use what became shorthand as a private detective, but search agencies to find things. So not everything that private investigators did, in parentheses, was illegal, but it does sound sinister. And, you know, there's some of them, you know, had people followed around on motorbikes, you know, illegally pulling phone records and things like that. But there was such a race between news desks to have the best of, because it's a multi-million pound, you know, newspapers still bring in a huge amount of cash every single day. It's a great business to be in for the people who own them, because it does bring you that pure cash every day. And this is when it was millions and millions and millions every weekend. So it was a huge battle for circulation. So people did end up erring into criminality because of that. And we mentioned it before, it was such stress on a lot of these people, the very hardworking people on some of these news desks who were putting in proper long days, proper long weeks. It was their entire vocation. They wanted to get the story. But that pressure then turns into what happened. And obviously it ended up hurting a lot of people, including themselves. Most of them lost their jobs. The people who the phone hacked, they had their lives ruined. It doesn't seem to be any winners that came out of it.
It also seems, Andrew, that in that feeding frenzy, nobody was checking each other. It all just got out of control. It's almost like this spiral effect, and everybody's in that pit.
Yeah, and again, just picking up in the earlier conversation about doing what's morally right and knowing how you're going to sleep at night. Yeah, it's not just the news industry and like finance, any high-pressure environment where you don't get paid unless you deliver results. The incentive will always be there to bend rules. And that's where conventions that hold that in check, yeah, it's fine to have it written down on a piece of paper as a law, but it really is about the culture, about the places. And newsrooms are quite famously high intensity, high pressure areas. And woe to anyone who's a junior reporter on those who stands up and goes, well, I don't think we should be doing things like that. Well, then they get frozen out. And then, so what do you do? And so you can see how this happens. And again, this is where the senior leadership in the papers have to set that tone. But to Mick's point, if you're losing circulation for doing that, it's very easy to be principled when there's no cost. But when there is a cost,
I was approached twice to join the News of the World, 2004 and 2006. Again, I was not a big fish, but I was a decently sized fish in a small pond where I was on the Daily Star Sunday. And I thought about it, but I'd seen people go over there who hadn't worked in that organisation or in those newspapers. And it just hadn't worked out because it was such a high pressure environment. I mean, not everything that everyone was doing illegal. And that's, you got to make that case. A lot of those stories that they were doing was pure journalism as well. I mean, I think we've got got to remember that. A lot of those people on the News of the World, Sunday Mirror and places like that, we've discovered problems. Most of the people on those papers were very good journalists and they weren't criminals. There was only a few people who have ever been called out for this and been convicted. We've got to remember that. But so I thought about it and I thought, well, I don't think it's quite me. I think I'd end up getting chewed up. I mean, I work hard where I am, but this is really hard work. And it looks like these people are like news beasts. I can't deal with these. And people are saying, well, why have you turned that down? That opportunity, it's an opportunity of a lifetime. But as it turned out, it was one of the luckiest things I ever did, to be honest.
But then, I mean, the sense of, though, that all the press were complicit in some way, wasn't it, really? That, you know, feeding off the poisoned fruit.
Remember, it's not just the phone hacking. It's the payment. Public officials being paid off, police in on the act. You'd heard about this for ages, that the police would take money stories, but talk about destroying trust in public institutions. I mean, where does it even begin and end? Not just the police. You had civil servants selling stories. There were multiple actors in on this. Well, you know, it's a vested interest in no one, I suspect, for a long time wanting to question it because everyone's in on it, right?
But the unintended consequences of the big crackdown and police not talking to journalists anymore was seen recently in Nicola Bulley and her disappearance.
Yeah.
All the rumours came out and then the police started talking about publicly about her alcohol problems and menopausal problems when I think Stephen Wright in the Mail, who's their old crime correspondent, said they wouldn't have had this a few years ago before Leveson because the crime correspondent and the person leading the case would have had a quiet word. Look, here's the extenuating circumstances behind this. We don't think it's a murder or anything like that. And then that would have been communicated to the news desk, to the editor, and it wouldn't have been that massive front page, where is she story, because it would have been torn down. And it was because of that relationship that they had. And so it wasn't always a bad relationship between the police and journalists, and it did a public service in many ways.
Well, as Lucy said, there were consequences for all of this, and the Leveson inquiry was called to investigate the extent of press intrusion. It was, of course, televised and made compulsive viewing. But apart from the circus element, which we'll get on to, there were some shocking revelations from people such as, we mentioned earlier, the parents of Millie Dowler and Madeleine McCann. Mick, when all of this was going on, did you want to keep your head down as
yes,
a hack?
I certainly did. Luckily, again, I was deputy editor, sorry. The joy of appearing at Leveson went to my editor at the time, which was Hugh Whittle, and he acquitted himself fairly well, I think.
Was there a chance you were going to get called?
I think there was a chance anyone who'd been in a senior position in newspapers over those years. But, you know, I'd been on the Daily Star Sunday as deputy editor and news editor. So, you know, again, it shows how clean I was that I wasn't called for that one.
Squeaky clean.
Yeah. But yeah, there was, I think, all the editors of all the titles were called up for it. It was a fairly terrifying time just generally for, there was a good few years from when it, you know, from 2011 onwards, wasn't it? When the proper inquiry started, and then you called into question everything that you'd done. I remember we was pulled into offices and there was a huge stack of payments for the last 2 years to Express newspapers. And we were looking through there and we were saying, well, look through them. Is there any of them illegal payments? And thought, well, how can I tell from that? But we'll have a look. And then I had to go and see the company lawyers and we'd be quizzed about that because, you know, there's a lot of money. These businesses were all at stake. They'd seen what had happened to the News of the World and they all feared that, you know, journalists in there, that they could no longer trust their own journalists anymore just because there could be another phone hacker in there. And that's, as it turned out, there wasn't. But there was that huge fear and paranoia across those buildings across Fleet Street for a good few years.
If you're a hack that gets stories, like I imagine automatically the suspicion, whether you're a sports journalist, serious journalist, would have been that you did this the wrong way.
As a flack, though, what effect did it have on that side of the media?
In politics, there was this huge narrative that it was too much of a cozy relationship, right, between politicians and media moguls. And it wasn't, you know, held to account. There weren't high levels of transparency. I think there was nervousness for a time, for a bit, about what meetings were being had, and then they had to be declared, and who were you seen with, that kind of stuff. So it certainly did have that seismic impact. But those relationships have to carry on, they have to exist, they're important for accountability and democracy, and they've been going on since time began, so they couldn't be completely shut down. But yeah, it did make people very nervous.
And Andrew, in Canada, was there any, or was the papers just too nice and dull?
Well, you know, and again,
there was the big moose inquiry at the time.
you don't pay for stories in Canada. It's just not the done thing. So if you don't have that imperative, then it is down to the old shoe leather type journalism that you see. And, you know, as foreign as anything could be that this crowd would get up to this kind of stuff. And And when you work it through logically, I guess you could see, well, yeah, if you're getting all that stuff into the paper about, you know, whether it's salacious love stories and shagging and this, then I guess it makes a bit of sense that would happen. We're just too boring. People don't have sex in Canada, apparently. It's certainly not sex worthy.
Sure, can you ever get interesting? Or is it just
me having sex in a front? No.
With a moose, yeah?
You can have sex with a moose. Yeah, no. You know, certainly Canada would be well positioned to lead these moose sex block. Bonkbuster?
See, Mick, if Mick was still the Daily Star, there'd be a good page lead for you there, wouldn't it?
Well, of course. Well, yeah. You, the Stephen Harper's man with the moose.
Quite big with the moose, yeah.
Well, no, I think we're missing the obvious Canadian one, which is the beaver. That's a much better
fit.
Much better fit for this. Anyway, we digress. No, we're too boring to get into hacking and all that fun stuff.
Let's find out a bit more about inquiries now and how they work behind the scenes. Tom, we're talking about one particular huge inquiry here, and we know there have been many. How does anybody prepare for this form of public inquiry?
So I think that depends on the role you're going into the inquiry as. So I think typically you go in either as a victim, so someone who has suffered or been bereaved, or you go in as an expert, or you go in as the accused. And I've tended to work for people who've been accused of doing something wrong. So tended to be big corporations who have significantly messed up. And in that situation, when you're preparing, you're sort of working out how best to say sorry and exactly what you have done wrong and how you say I've done wrong. This is what I did wrong, this is why, and this is what I'm doing to fix it. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of care, because you want to make sure that you're apologizing for the right things and not the wrong things, particularly if you're a big publicly listed company, for example.
Well, that actually makes me think of Grenfell, because anything that I've read about the inquiry or seen, you know, people being cross-examined, it doesn't seem like anyone said sorry.
There's only a few opportunities that you have to say sorry. So actually, every witness who's given evidence at the Grenfell Tower inquiry, at the end, the last question they are asked is if they'd like to say anything else to the people who've died and their families. So there has been an opportunity there for people to say sorry. And actually, in terms of the news clippings, that's often what's shown is the person breaking down. But the vast majority of what is discussed at the inquiry is your day-to-day work life. It's why did you send this email 5 years ago? It's what did you mean by putting this comma in this place in this sentence? It's examining some of the cultural stuff that we've talked about here and some of the incentives that cause people, particularly in big organizations, to make decisions which are just wrong and in many cases criminal.
In a PR perspective, Giles, sorry seems to be the hardest word.
Yeah, often it is for people, but there's nothing worse than a qualified apology, right?
Nothing.
There's nothing worse. You may as well just not say anything or double down on things. I cannot stand seeing people, you know, and they get kind of caught up in these very legalistic terminology, which, you know, lack any sense of empathy, look like they've been spending money on expensive lawyers as well. It's 10 times worse. But I think there's a huge issue, right, about saying sorry, and you see it in public life. People need to apologize more. I got it wrong. I screwed up. Actually, people want to hear that more because everyone's human.
And that's why people employ us, right? It's to find that narrow line you can walk where you give a real proper apology, where you really do admit what you've done wrong, but you also still work within the boundaries of what you can legally say in terms of admitting certain liability and not admitting certain liability.
Some people keep making this. Matt Hancock, for example, keeps being dragged out to make some sort of apology, and he still can't do it.
Well, I think he knows that they'll stop calling him to come to things like television cameras if he were to ever apologize fulsomely, and so he keeps the dream alive. And I'm only half joking there. We all hate saying sorry in our private lives. Imagine it is, you know, you're the one on the dock having to apologize for decisions an organization or institution or an industry has taken. If you look at Grenfell, you have local councils having budgets to do refurbishments. You have various providers incentivized to bid on the cheap to do that. And at every step, somebody in the organization has to go. If this goes poorly, it would mean a building goes up like a Christmas candle and a bunch of people die. Is this worth doing? Knowing that could be, you know, it's a classic line in our industry is, if you don't want to see it on the front page, don't say it. And that is more true than ever now, because there's more ways for information to get out there. But you always have to work it through to the end and go, if this all came out, would I sleep at night? And I bet you a lot of people involved in Grenfell now to go, well, de facto, there's 100 plus people that aren't sleeping anymore because they're dead. And you can never PR your way out of that. That's unrecoverable. So at the end, you have to determine that the best thing to do is apologize. And that means your business goes down because you get, well, then that's the consequence of your decision. And the families, I can assure you, would appreciate hearing somebody come out and go, we fucked up.
Just
we were greedy little bastards. We shouldn't have done it. We see the consequence. We will do whatever we can through this inquiry or otherwise to make sure it never happens again. Learn all the lessons so that no family has to go through what you're going through. We're sorry.
And I think most people I've worked with really do get that. I think the challenge you always get is when it's a massive multinational and it's one department in one country has completely cocked up and they've brought this whole company's name through the mud because there was a small team that completely cocked up and did some really evil things and some people paid horrific prices. And then there's that whole balancing act of, are thousands, tens of thousands of jobs going to suffer? Are the pension funds that are invested in some of these companies going to suffer and things like that? And you get into really difficult moral questions. And also, you know, as the leader of some of those companies, you've got shareholder obligations and things like that, which limit, again, what you can say in it. It's really grim, but that's why the important work of inquiries is so important, because the truth does get out and it provides a proper context for those apologies to be made. And importantly, it provides, hopefully, some closure for the victims.
Not everybody hated the Leveson inquiry, did they? Hugh Grant loved it. Some people got very excited about the opportunity to stick it to the boys.
Well, he felt a little sore, didn't he? Because I remember long lens pictures of him and Liz Hurley out the back of their garden trying to make it up afterwards as well. So he felt he'd been treated very, very badly by the press, you know, when Hacked Off started up and he joined in with that organisation and bringing to light all the bad things the press had done. No, he, you know, fair play to him. He'd had it given out and he was doling it back out as well. So, you know, in a
never seen him
way,
look happier.
I do remember the day the Leveson, the report came back. I was editing that day. So one, that was a bad day. And we all thought that was it. He was going to try and shut down all newspapers. 2 days before, my wife had bought a French bulldog for some reason. I don't know why, but it was a puppy. But subsequently, she became very ill with food poisoning. And it was been, then she was sick for 24 hours. So the day of the Leveson report, and I'm going out there thinking, well, we still have newspapers by the end of the day. I stood on a puppy French bulldog that was in the front room and my wife was vomiting up for 24 hours. So I thought, well, I was saying goodbye to my career. My wife was dying and I'd killed a dog. As it turned out, everything turned
not
out
a good
all
day.
Right. It was all right in the end. But yes, I do remember the Leveson report for other reasons.
Charlotte Church, let's talk about her.
Voice of an angel.
A voice of an angel. Oh, she could have had £100,000 because she was hacked as well. £100,000. Or good coverage.
Again, her and Steve McFadden were the ones at that time, always on the front of every single one of them. Again, she had a fairly colourful relationship with a young man back in Wales. And I
was
think
he a rugby player?
No, there was Gavin Henson, but before then there was
she had a
guy, childhood
was a
sweetheart.
It was a bit of a rogue, wasn't he?
He was. And I think that obviously some reporters got to him and then a lot of people around them were selling stories, but there was a lot of people being phone hacked as well at the same time. I think it affected Maria, her mother, as well. And I think in the end, she ended up splitting up with her husband, the father, as well. And again, she's very right to do it. She blamed the press for a lot of things. And then this story came out that Rupert Murdoch wanted him to sing at his wedding. And then there was talk that she'd been offered £100,000 for it, or she could get some good coverage. And she was only, you know, a child at the time. So this was through agents and things like that. So, you know, it was a huge amount of pressure on her. And again, she's now spent the rest of her life fighting against the press. And so, you know, some people did have their moment. But again, did anyone win in the end? I don't know.
Well, that's all for today. Huge thanks, of course, to Giles, Mick, Andrew, Tom, and of course, to Lucy Benjamin. Now, we'll be hearing more from her later in the series. So do keep listening for further details. And we'll see you next time for more Hacks and Flacks. Goodbye. Hacks and Flacks is presented by me, Petri Hoskin, produced by Amanda Redman, and brought to you by Trafalgar Strategy. If you want to get in touch with your take on the current news climate, you can do that by emailing us at hackflackpod@gmail.com. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time on Hacks and Flacks.